We're going to listen to the first part of this discussion. This is really special to have had the chance to talk with Jimmy Nauna of the Pacific Concerns Resource Center. For many, many years, we've been receiving information about fallout, literally, from colonization of the South Pacific, including birth defects and a high mortality rate because of all the nuclear weapons testing of by the United States, France, and other countries. As you'll hear in the story tonight, actually, it's shocking, but the experience of people in these small islands echoes what has been the story for First Nations and land-based cultures around the world. So energy development, clear-cutting, mining, and believe it or not, free trade. It's called the Pacific Area Regional Trade Agreement. And anyway, you'll hear all about it right from Jimmy Nauna here on Native Solidarity News.
This show has come about because of many emails that we've been receiving about different human rights abuses and indigenous sovereignty movements in Fiji. We will hopefully be giving a good background today to, first of all, who are the indigenous people of the South Pacific, but also what is happening now that that people need to know about in Canada. So first I'd just like to ask you to introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. My name is Jimmy Nauna, and as I said, I'm Assistant Director on for the Colonization Desk of the Pacific Concerns Resource Center in Fiji. I'm originally from Kanaki, New Caledonia, which is another part of the Pacific region, and I've been posted in Fiji for nearly 3 years now, so I'm heading the campaign on decolonization and indigenous rights issues in the Pacific.
What was the... Can you give some examples of what indigenous communities were like in the South Pacific before colonization?
Well, I guess talking about the Pacific is a very wide issue. When you talk about indigenous peoples in the Pacific, there's, you know, about more than 50 countries, and some of those countries are hosted to more than one indigenous population. In general, we're talking about people who have moved to the islands of the Pacific and have settled here some 40,000 years, 50,000 years ago, and who have now faced the issue of decolonization and or colonization rather, and today the issue of globalization, which is taking over as well in the Pacific. So we're not dealing only with one specific indigenous population, but the whole range of population or whole range of indigenous issues in the Pacific that we're dealing with, and beyond the Pacific as well.
What were some of the colonial contacts? Was it France and England? And how has this affected the situation historically?
Yes, in fact, if you look at the Pacific from the colonial era, it's been well colonized by the major colonial powers in those times, 19th century, namely Britain, France, also Germany in some parts of the Pacific, and U.S., United States in the Pacific Rim or Northern Pacific, which comprise of Hawaii, Guam, the Marshall Islands, and some other U.S. territories. But at this point in time now, some countries have attained independence since the 1960s, and today we only have remaining colonies of France, Britain, and the United States. Another odd colonial situation is West Papua, or the eastern half of Papua New Guinea, which is still under dispute between Indonesia, which has invaded the country in the 1970s, and its former administering colonial power, which was the Netherlands, the crown of the Netherlands. So that's that would be a specific issue to colonialism in the Pacific, but most of the countries have been colonized by France, Britain, and the United States. And that's what we have as remaining territories of the Pacific, or the remaining colonies that we have today.
For the countries that have, at least on paper, had their political independence recognized, are there kind of neo-colonial power structures that you, like the kind that you see in Africa or Latin America, where it's still the mass of the people are not controlling their fate, or have there been important victories in indigenous sovereignty movements and so on?
I think when we look at and the process of decolonization in the Pacific over the last decades, you know, as early as the 1960s, when the first country attained independence, countries have said to become independent in their own structures, but the remaining governing bodies, like parliaments and the political systems and constitutions, are still very much based on the colonial and the former colonial institutions that were laid down after colonialism. So, in one way, or in other words, we're talking about independent nations, but the structures themselves, the national institutions and political institutions, are still very much based on what was there during colonial time. The parliamentary system in English or former English colonies are still remain based on the Westminster system, as well as the adversarial system in parliament. So, in one way, they are independent institutionally, but politically and economically, no, they are still very much dependent on foreign aid and foreign influence. So, I guess, yeah, it's the same situation as it happened in Africa after they gained independence as well. Countries have not been able to develop their own institutions, their own political systems based on the indigenous political system, indigenous governing system that they used to have before colonialism.
Is it hard to get international governments or organizations like the United Nations even to recognize that there are indigenous people in the South Pacific?
Well, within the United Nations system, there is what they call the Special Committee on Decolonization, which is now into its maybe 20 or 30 years, and it has helped some of the countries in the Pacific to access to independence. But so far, there's still about 17 territories in the Pacific that are still non-self-governing and which are still struggling and striving for self-determination and independence or any other option of decolonization. Part of those territories are listed on the UN or that committee's list of countries to be decolonized, but another part of it, which is almost more than half of it, are still pushing and lobbying at the UN to be listed as countries that have to be decolonized under the 1960 Declaration of Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples, and under other United Nations conventions and international legal agreements. And so that's part of the major campaign of PCRC Desk on decolonization, is to campaign and lobby the United Nations to list those countries under their list of countries to be decolonized. So the United Nations is aware of the situation of non-self-governing territories in the Pacific, but it has taken more than two decades and more than two international decades for indigenous people to see any progress in the listing of those countries. Up to 2000, it was the first international decade on the eradication of colonialism. And after the seminar in 2000, the United Nations and the Decolonization Committee opted for a second decade for eradication of colonialism. So it might take another decade before those countries are listed finally at the UN, and probably another two or three decades before they are completely independent, before they completely access to the option of independence and self-determination from those territories.
Can you talk about what the major interests of foreign powers have been in the region, whether in a colonial setting or in the context of economic globalization?
Yes, I think in this world of globalization and free trade the major, I would say the major interest of major countries in the Pacific is not, is certainly the economic benefit that they can have out of the Pacific territories and Pacific countries in general. I mean, even independent countries of the Pacific are still subject to international trade and trade regulations under WTO and so on. And so in the 80s and 90s, there was much talk about, and there was a general view that the major interest of those big powers in the Pacific was for a strategic reason during the Cold War. But at the end of the Cold War, I think now it has turned into a more economic and commercial benefit that that still hold the interest of those great nations to the Pacific. The Pacific is a very vast region, and it holds, I think, the greatest economic zone in terms of land and especially in terms of sea and you know its resources. So that's where, I guess that's where those great powers see the benefit of maintaining colonies in the Pacific and being able to tap into the resources of those countries, whether they're independent or not. Also the availability and the richness of natural resources in the Pacific, not only in land but at sea as well, is also a major benefit for those countries to remain present in the Pacific.
So we're talking about a situation where a lot of the power structures that have set up the modern world were dependent on naval power, for example, who controlled the seas and the flow of marine trade. Now, in the South Pacific, also you have the experience of having been used as a testing ground for nuclear weapons, and there is a movement for the denuclearization of the Pacific. Can you talk about that?
Of course, I didn't mention that as well. The Pacific has been housed to has been used as testing ground for nuclear powers, namely France, the United States, Britain. France has tested in the Pacific for a long time, very long time, especially in Polynesia, or what they call French Polynesia, Terre Maori. The U.S. has been testing its nuclear devices in the U.S. territories of Northern Pacific, Guam, the Marshall Islands, and other territories. And Britain in Australia and Christmas Island, which is closer to Fiji. And so although those the nuclear major nuclear campaigns ended you know at the end of not even last decade, some of those countries are still eyeing the Pacific as a testing ground for further nuclear weaponry. So part of the major campaigns of PCRC as well and other organizations in the Pacific is to clear out the Pacific of all these nuclear weapons and nuclear transshipment through Pacific waters and all that has to do with nuclear. We declare our movement a nuclear free and independent Pacific, which means what it means. I mean, we don't want to see any more of nuclear weapons and nuclear devices in the waters or in the lands of the Pacific. People have suffered so much for so long, so it's about time that those countries pack up their nuclear devices and test it on their own ground. If they say it's safe, test it in Paris or store it in Washington or test it in London. If they say it's safe.
Yeah.
This is something we had Priscilla Setti, who actually helped set up this discussion, was talking about all the birth defects, the cancers, and so on. You know, it's not, I guess it's important to say, because it's not obvious for everyone what the implications are of Indigenous peoples' lands in general, even in the southwestern U.S. and northern and western Canada, for example, being used as toxic dumping grounds. There's another more recent development, which is sort of the opposite of being used as a dumping ground, which is being coveted as a for, I guess, biodiversity and genetic resources. There have been examples of Indigenous peoples' DNA sequences being being patented without their consent, you know, through blood samples being taken and so on. Can you talk about the importance of this issue, the heritage, the rich heritage of the peoples of the South Pacific, and why this is a problem, this kind of a biopiracy?
Yes, one of the that's another major issue that the Pacific is facing at a regional level is the question of intellectual property rights, which across any other issues. Talking about intellectual property rights in the Pacific, we're dealing as well with traditional knowledge as well as the testing of genes. And there are some examples in the Pacific where some international pharmaceutical companies have come to an agreement with some Pacific governments to be able to sample blood in some specific population of the Pacific and of some countries. And that's a major threat to Indigenous people in the Pacific. We see it as biocolonialism, another way of colonizing the people and the land. After colonialism, they went for natural resources of the islands. Now they're going for the biological richness of the population. So it's very, very threatening to view such agreement being being endorsed by governments of some governments in the Pacific for international or multinational companies to use those genes of pools of genes for their own purposes. So it's just another way of colonizing people in the Pacific, and especially Indigenous people. So the intellectual property rights issue in the Pacific is very much a concern to the indigenous people, and also in terms of sovereignty, in terms of self-determination from the people. It's really worse than the colonialism that happened in the 60s or early on. It's a major threat in the Pacific now that has to be addressed urgently.
There's also maybe the last major issue I'd like to bring up, and then we're going to talk about the more recent developments support actions that people can take listening to this program. The issue of tourism. This is, again, something that is of very big impact to Indigenous peoples, not only in the South Pacific, but around the world. A lot of people see that there is such a thing as ecotourism that can be helpful for supporting Indigenous economies. Other people will say that it is another kind of colonialism, and this kind of development is not something that is chosen by local people. How do you see the problems and of tourism and the opportunities, I guess, for economic self-sufficiency in the modern economic context?
Well, I would see ecotourism as an option for, you know, indigenous people's participation in the economy of the international economy. But on the other hand, ecotourism brings as much, downfall as well for local indigenous populations, especially in small communities. I think ecotourism is an alternative, but as long as the people themselves, as long as people themselves manage the project or the ecotourism project that they want to put in place. There are many ways to benefit from ecotourism for indigenous populations in terms of diversifying the economy and making their participation in the national economy easier. But what I fear is that ecotourism just develops into another major touristic attraction, just as having big hotels and five stars hotels in their communities. I think ecotourism has to come from bottom up if it has to be of benefit to indigenous populations themselves, because there is a lot, and there's many aspects of ecotourism, and it implies the control of natural resources by the indigenous population themselves. I would see it as an alternative, but as long as people and indigenous people themselves are in control of the ecotourism industry and not just some foreign tour operators who come and impose upon the local communities the idea of ecotourism. But there's definitely a way to work out the better solution for both.
What are some of the campaigns that you are working on right now, and what is the role of the international community in them?
At PCRC at the moment, we're working on different campaigns desk, ranging from decolonization to demilitarization, which involves nuclear issues in the Pacific, environment, sustainable human development, and free trade areas and some other major issues. But the major ones that we focus on at the moment is the issue of decolonization for the non-self-governing territories in the Pacific. At an environmental level, the sea level rise, which, as you may know, is really threatening to the Pacific, especially in the small islands of the Pacific, and sustainable human development, targeting or tackling issues of genetically modified organisms, and as we're talking about, ecotourism, how people can sustain themselves in this world of globalization. So those are major issues that would require international support in terms of lobbying at their own government level. Another major issue that we face in the Pacific is the question of mining and logging. And most of those major companies that log forestries in the Pacific and mine in the Pacific are from overseas, and you certainly know some of them based in Canada. Falcon Bridge is one example, Rio Tinto in the US, and CRA in Australia. Some are those major multinational mining companies who are operating in the Pacific. So the support that we would require from the international community, especially our partners overseas, and specifically in Northern America, is to lobby at government level and being able to influence the decision of their government in terms of allocating permits to those multinationals to operate in the Pacific, or at least put a hold on to their destructive operations in the Pacific, which is affecting directly indigenous populations in those small countries of the Pacific. And another request that we would have from our partners, overseas and international community in general, is to inform us of what the track records of those companies are in their own territories and in their own countries. I mean, we tend to be open-ended to multinationals. I mean, Pacific governments tend to open arms to international companies who want to operate in the Pacific, but we're not as well informed of their track records where they operate in their own country and other parts of the world. So I think there's a link there to be set up between our organizations in the Pacific, especially our indigenous organizations in the Pacific, and indigenous partners and non-government organizations in other parts of the world where they know more about about how those international companies operate and what's their track record in terms of environment, in terms of involving indigenous people in their development projects and other issues.
Yeah. If people would like to get in touch with the Pacific Concerns Resource Center, can I give your email address?
Sure, yes. We also have a website which we are still updating, but people can browse through and see what campaigns we involved in and who are our partners overseas. And we actually cover not only the Pacific, but we do have affiliate organizations in Northern Pacific and North America, and including the U.S. and Canada and other parts of Europe and Asia. Our close partners in Canada are Pacific People's Partnership. It used to be a South Pacific People's Foundation, I think. And coming up, there's a major conference to be held in Canada sometimes around June on the issue of Pacific, specifically on Pacific issues. So if people are interested, I think the contact would be at PPP, Pacific People's Partnership, and they would provide more information on our campaign and how they can support us in the Pacific and work together on issues of common concerns. The PCRC email is, for general information, is pcrc@is.com.fj.
That's is.com?
Sorry, yeah, .com.fj. And the website is www.pcrc.org.fj.
I'd just like to ask if there's anything else that you would like to send as a message to people in Canada.
Well, a message of solidarity first to our indigenous brothers and sisters in the north, in North America, who I believe would face the same situation as we do in the Pacific. Confronting multinationals and other issues of land rights and so on, but to the general public who have a heart in Pacific issues, I would appeal to them to provide more support to indigenous peoples in the Pacific and to provide support in our campaigns for a nuclear-free Pacific and a decolonized Pacific. That's our major appeal to them. On a daily basis, to provide information to us whenever they can on issues that they think are relevant to our campaigns and would help us enhance our lobbying against governments and against multinationals. I should also like to thank them for the support that they've been providing so far, and we will always be knowledgeable to that support, and we always will be open to any advice and be happy to cooperate further and work together towards a more just world and a better world for everyone, both in the north and the south.
It's amazing that we can even know about each other's work in this way and to talk in this forum. I'm very grateful. It's been a lot of work to make this program happen, and I
finally did it. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much, Jimmy.
Thank you, Adam. It was nice talking to you.
Yeah. So that is Jimmy Nauna of the Pacific Concerns Resource Center here on Native Solidarity News, talking about all of the different issues, historical and current, in terms of indigenous sovereignty in the South Pacific.
right, you are listening to Native Solidarity News, and that was Jimmy Nuna of the Pacific Concerns Resource Center in Fiji talking about the decolonization of the South Pacific after European and North American incursion, which continues in this day and age in the form of clear-cut logging, mining, energy development, and free trade. And the nuclear weapons testing issue and nuclear waste disposal issue is unfortunately not dead either. So if you want to get in touch with the PCRC, as it's known, you can email them at the following address. It's JNAOUNA at PCRC.org.fj. For Fiji. It'll be your first email to Fiji, and if email doesn't work, give a call to Native Solidarity News and we'll find another way to send some support south. Again, thanks to Priscilla Seti of the University of Saskatchewan and the Indigenous Women's Network for setting up that meeting. And Native Solidarity News can be reached at 514-486-0246 and nsn@tao.ca.